The Socialist Party, having a grouping of workers in it, and claiming to have some kind of a claim on the mantle of Marxism, started to develop a left wing made up of these workers and a little group of intellectuals that had learned a lesson from the Russian Revolution. And on top of that, they had learned a few lessons from the anti-war struggle that was taking place in Europe, although it was an embryonic form. That is the great demonstration of Karl Liebknecht in Germany when he distributed leaflets on May Day in the big square in Berlin, denouncing the war and so forth. And then the news of Zimmerwald, where Lenin and a couple of other Russians tried to mobilize the anti-war elements from the various European parties and start the foundation of a new international. This news spread to the United States. And it resulted, and the lessons that were learned from that, plus the lessons of the first 2 years of terrible slaughter in Europe, had created a left wing inside the Socialist Party. And this left wing became the rallying center of all the anti-war elements in this country. They marched out of the Socialist Labor Party, they marched out of the IWW, and they coalesced inside the Socialist Party under a left wing. And it was this left wing that over a period of years and through development and internal struggle inside the Socialist Party, it became the founding members of the communist movement in this country. Now we have to ask ourselves a question. Up to this time, up to 1914, all the countries in Europe had a socialist movement. The German Socialist Party movement, Social Democratic movement, was looked upon as the greatest stronghold of Marxism in the world. It was the model party that all other socialist parties tried to use as a model to build their own party. And when the war came, on the other hand, there was another socialist party that was quite prominent in the ranks of the Second International, which is the Socialist International, and that was the Russian Party of Russian Socialists. And they were distinguished not for their great strength and great size and so forth, but they were distinguished by the fact that there had been a revolution in Russia in 1905 that had been defeated nevertheless, but alongside of this defeat had grown during the revolution a working class organization called the Soviets, or what we would call in this country CIO Council, or State Federation of Labor, or along that line. An organization that spontaneously developed from the working class and coalesced into the workers' councils. And this council, this grouping of workers, in its first stages of development, because the revolution was defeated shortly after, in the first stages of its development, under the leadership of Trotsky, who was 26 years of age at that time, laid down the challenge to Russian imperialism, to the Russian Tsarism, in the name of the Russian working class. Well, it was defeated, to make a long story short. And from that time until 1914, there was a constant struggle among the Russian socialists as to what was the road to challenge Tsarism on. And I say they played a role inside the Second International up to 1914, not because of size, but because of the intensity of the struggle between these two groupings inside the Russian party. And the Germans, having the great authority inside the Second International, were more or less the arbiters of this struggle. And they naturally sided with the Mensheviks. Now, the Russian party was looked upon as a trouble, as a bunch of quarrelsome, as a party led by a group of troublesome and quarrelsome left-wingers. Nothing could please them. They were at odds not only with the right wing of their own party, but they carried on a struggle inside of other socialist parties throughout Europe, which was quite unlawful as far as these leaderships of the various socialist parties were concerned, because each one of them looked upon the socialist party of their country as their own private preserve. that, of course, naturally they talk of internationalism on May Day, just like a politician in this country will give a sermon about the American Revolution on July 4th, and then go back to rob the treasury at night. Well, it's the same type of element. Careerists and opportunists led the Second International. Now, in Russia, this internal struggle that went on, and precisely because it was a most backward country in Europe, precisely because it had seen the development of capitalism all over Europe, and had seen the results of the development of capitalism, had seen that by replacing feudalism by capitalism, mankind was still enslaved in a different form of slavery and so forth. Learning all these lessons, a grouping inside the Russian socialist movement negated any development of capitalism in Tsarist Russia. They said, we can leap over that, right into a socialist society by a seizure of power by the socialists. And on the other hand, there was another section of the Russian party that didn't believe it was possible never committed itself to the seizure of power through a revolution, through a capitalist revolution, that recognized that we had to have a capitalist revolution, and from there we'll stand pat and see what develops and wait for the European revolution to take place. And from there we would march and make our decisions as to what should be done in Russia. On the other hand, there was the right-wingers, who were the same as the German Social Democrats, the British, the French, and the rest of them. Now this led to a great study of Marxism, precisely because these questions were being debated and fought over and so forth and so on. Factions developed inside the Russian movement, and eventually there was a split between two groupings named the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. And we know that out of the revolution, under the leadership of the Bolsheviks, came the foundations of a socialist society. Well, this gave them great authority all over the world. No longer did serious-minded workers and intellectuals inside the Second International look to the Germans for guidance. They recognized the fact that the German leadership was rotten to the core, that they had sold out socialism for their own nationalism and as lackeys for the capitalists of their country. And the ones to look up to now were not the Germans, but those that had accomplished a successful revolution, and that was the Bolsheviks of the USSR. And from that time on, all the workers and intellectuals throughout the world in the Second International rallied to the defense of the revolution that was accomplished in the Soviet Union. Now, naturally, the question comes up, well, how come that they were the ones? How come this party that was torn by factional dispute, that was continually arguing and fighting not only among themselves, but fighting with the other parties of the Second International, how come that they were the only ones that accomplished the socialist revolution? And it led to an intensified study of the teachings of Marxism and the teachings of the organizational concepts of Lenin. Now, Lenin was an orthodox Marxist. And one of his great contributions, among his several great contributions to the field of Marxism, was his insistence on orthodox Marxism. He didn't say, well, Marx had some pretty good ideas, but I'm going to improve them. My name is Max Lerner, or my name is John Spargo, my name is Thomas, Norman Thomas, or some other a stupid intellectual like you see running up and down the landscape in the United States and yakking about socialism on May Day. No, Lenin said, I accept everything of Marxism, particularly Marxist conception of philosophy, that is dialectical materialism. Everything's in a state of evolution. Nothing stands still. Everything changes. Everything changes through contradictions and so forth. This, of course, was rejected by the great leaders of the Second International. And Lenin further, in his struggles in building his organization, the Bolsheviks, insisted on orthodoxy in the class struggle. That is, that there's no such a thing as class peace. There's a class struggle between those that have and those that haven't. And Marxism says that this must eventually lead to a clash between the two classes, and that the working class would ultimately conquer power, and that they had to clamp on a dictatorship in order to hold power. Lenin accepted that 100%, and there was no dispute. That's what caused the split between, we might say, the Mensheviks. At least it was an underlying cause of the split between the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks. Now, in order to achieve this, Lenin had some definite ideas on how to build a party. Now, if you're going to build a nice big vote-catching machine, like the socialists did when they founded their party in this country, we remember we said it was founded by trade union bureaucrats who wanted to get out of the Socialist Labor Party, because Daniel De Leon had, as a socialist leader, had put the party on record against the leadership of the American Federation of Labor. And the Socialist Labor Party paper carried on a vicious campaign against these sellout artists. Well, if I'm a young, ambitious young man in the American Federation of Labor, and I'm looking to get ahead in this world, which would be a real American way, and I'm going to get ahead by bootlicking some big trade union leader, hey, it's no use of me being a socialist, because if he finds out I belong to the party of Daniel De Leon, I'm not going to get very far. So I'm in revolt against Daniel De Leon. And I am the type that helped start the Socialist Party in this country, alongside of all these do-gooders that Daniel De Leon drove out of the Socialist Labor Party. All these ideas of building, all these gentlemen that were looking forward to building a vote-catching machine to further their political careers, all were driven out of the Socialist Labor Party and started the Socialist Party. Now, if you have that kind of a concept, that socialism means getting elected to the Boston City Council so you can make a motion to increase the police force 500 new cops so as we can do away with thievery in the city, there's not much socialism in that. If you're a socialist and you're going to keep your mouth shut about the thieves that are running the union, that's part of the being a good socialist in the Socialist Party, you aren't going to get too excited about building a real strong Socialist Party. And the result is that when you're building the party, you're going to build a flabby, loosely disciplined organization so that no one's going to interfere with my democratic rights to be a bootlicker for my trade union leader. And nobody's going to interfere with my democratic rights to run to be a mayor of Boston on the promise of cleaning up the sewers or building better streets and such foolish things as those things, as we called it in those days, sewer socialism. Well, the result was that they built a party that was flabby. And being flabby and undisciplined, that is undisciplined to the right wing, not to the left wing. All these reformist parties have no discipline when it comes to the right wing. They show their teeth only to the left wing, which is the working class in general. On the other hand, if you are going to build a party that you intend to lead into struggle with the capitalist class, to lock horns with the capitalist class, and not only that, but you're going to lead them into a life and death struggle to the seizure of power and the institution of a socialist society, you're going to build a different kind of a party, isn't that right? Common sense. In other words, the party is a reflection of your political concepts. Don't forget that, comrades. Organizational ideas flow from political concepts. If you're going to be wishy-washy in politics and you're going to be a half-baked socialist, you belong to a half-baked organization where you say one thing, I say another thing, we all say 10 different, we have 10 different answers for every problem. In other words, there's no unity and discipline. But if we are determined to lead a struggle for socialism, we have to build a different kind of an organization, and that is an organization based on democratic centralism. Now, Lenin's party was the only party that was built that way. The only party. The Mensheviks claimed to build a party along that line. But Lenin's party was entirely different. It was a party built on a very strong discipline, and the leadership carried the authority and passed it down into the ranks. The leadership had almost unlimited authority in the party because of the brutality of Russian Tsarism and so forth. Now, this was a great contribution to the international working class on how to build a revolutionary organization that could challenge the capitalist for power. And in the founding of the Communist International, this kind of a concept was adopted internationally to build an international revolutionary organization. This was another contribution that Lenin made towards the working class, and that is that the struggle is international, not national. And from that time on, all revolutionary parties have been built since then have either been based on internationalism or they faded from the picture before they had hardly grown up. We could name a few of them. Oh, the PSOP in France, which started out with about 10,000 members, 1937. The first shell was fired in the Second World War, and the PSOP disappeared. The SAP in Germany, founded a split off of the right wing that got kicked out of the Communist Party. Had known internationalism, that disappeared around 1934-35, after Hitler had taken power. And then the Dutch party, RSOP, I think it was, they disappeared. The same thing. The only parties that can survive today are parties based on internationalism. Now, naturally, when these splits took place in the socialist parties or any other organization throughout the world and rallied to the support of the Russian Revolution, naturally, they looked to the Russians for leadership. After all, these men had accomplished the job. They had already finished it. They had done the job. Their theories had proven correct. And on top of that, they themselves must be great leaders if they could foresee how to develop a revolutionary party, and also how they could develop a revolutionary theory that would fit in with the overall picture of how to overthrow their rulers, so that they had practically unlimited authority inside the Communist International when it was founded. They won that by the deed. This also changed the whole political picture throughout the world in the working class movement. The Second International learned nothing, what is now the Second International, learned nothing from the lessons, of course, of the Russian Revolution. Instead of that, the veil that they wore and hid behind and kid the working class along that they were a working class organization was pulled from their face, and they were revealed as nothing but a collection of petty bourgeois leaders who had very little in common with the working class outside of political vote catching. And to this day, the Second International is led by petty bourgeois elements, that is, professors and lawyers mainly, and so forth, up and down the line, whether it's in England, where you have Wilson running around as the leader of the working people, and hardly get elected when he told the working class, sorry, but your wages are frozen, brother. He's a good leader of the working class. And in Germany, a couple of ex-Nazis and so forth. You have to be broad-minded, you know. You can't be one of these stupid working people that remember things. So the whole Second International is the same as the leadership in this country of the skeleton socialist party, made up of do-gooders, professional people, Bible chasers, and so forth. The Third International changed all that. The Third International demanded a professional leadership. In other words, the leaders of the parties of the Third International had to devote all their time to the business of revolution, which was quite a great step forward. Because in the Second International parties, the same, even up to this very day, the men and the women that really carry on the day-to-day struggle of the party to keep it alive, that put out the paper and so forth and so on, the organizers of the party are nothing but flunkies. Nothing but flunkies for the leadership of Norman Thomas and a couple of other broken-down ministers and doctors and lawyers and so forth. And they're the doctors and the lawyers are the front men of the party. They are the leaders. Whereas the ones that do the work are nothing but party hacks. Now that was all changed. You became a professional revolutionary if you wanted to be any kind of a leader in this Third International. In other words, the Russian Revolution caused a realignment of the working class throughout the world. And in the United States, the Third International, the Communist Party, was founded by this split-off that came out of the Socialist Party after the left-wing had rallied the better elements from the IWW, the Socialist Labor Party, and inside itself, the Socialist Party. Then I explained last week how the Palmer Raids took place, and thousands upon thousands of workers, foreign workers, were rounded up and deported to the various countries from which they came. There was no such a thing as trials and things of that nature. As a young boy, I can remember the papers at that time telling how another ship just sailed with 600 of these dirty old foreigners. They couldn't even speak English, and they come here causing all this trouble. Well, we get rid of them. And this went on for month after month, hundreds and hundreds of foreign workers being deported right here from the city of Boston itself. And this strengthened the party because it cleared the party of a lot of elements that through a mistake had rallied to the Russian Revolution, thinking that they were real Bolsheviks. But as a matter of fact, when the first pressure came, they scrammed. And the party was cleansed of these half-hearted elements and got down to brass tacks. Now, one of the main tasks confronting the young Communist Party in this country was to learn Marxism. They knew nothing about Marxism. That was the first big job of the communist movement. And naturally, the only place when they wanted to learn Marxism, naturally they turned to those people that had the badge, that had the authority, and they were the Russians. So that if they wanted to know how to build a party, how to interpret Marxism and so forth, they had to turn to the Russians. Not only that, but the various political problems that came up in these various parties throughout the world. The answers that the various national parties looked to Moscow for an answer, because the Bolsheviks were experienced in all the various problems that had developed inside their own party, and they were passing this experience on to the world parties. For instance, in this country, the first big task that the Russians were confronted with was the question of being asked to help a section of the American Communist Party that was against having an underground party when the Palmer Raid period had already passed away. The Palmer Raids took place in 1921, and by 22 it was easing off. The question came up, the Communist Party was driven underground, of course, in order to survive. It would be foolish to stay above board and let the government pick off the membership one by one. So instead of that, it went underground. Now the question came when things were easing off. The question came of getting above ground and carrying on political work above board. It's always easier to work above board than underground, in the underground. Now there was a section of the party that objected to this. And it was through the help of the Communist International, by a section of the leadership going to Moscow and explaining the situation in the United States, that the Communist International came out in favor of the American Party becoming a legalized above board party. Now this was real help to the development of the American Communist Party. Shortly after that, without going into all the details of the interworkings of the American Communist Movement, shortly after that came a big struggle inside the party about looking for shortcuts because of the isolation of the party. We must remember that in those days, the same as today, in a big wave of prosperity, the American Communists couldn't get a word in edgewise. The workers weren't going to listen to anyone talking about revolution when they were living off the fat of the land as they are living off the fat of the land today. And the result was that there was a section of the party that was yelling for a labor party. And they had deluded themselves into the idea that the great masses of workers were pushing for a labor party, when as a matter of fact they weren't. And Shachtman got off a wise crack at that time. Not at that time, but in analyzing this, this struggle that went on inside the American Communist Party, they had a convention in Chicago to build the Labor Party. And Shachtman said that the opposition, that is Fitzpatrick and his gang, came there with credentials from the masses. And the Communist Party came there with masses of credentials. Didn't mean anything. Each communist represented, like you represented the workers from Methuselah, and I represented the workers from Brighton, that was my wife and myself, and so forth. All these foolish credentials which didn't mean a goddamn thing. That was a regular trick of the Communist Party, even up to this day, these fake credentials. Well, the result was that the party was stagnant, fighting over this question of a Labor Party, and that was referred to Moscow also in 1923. And the Communist International, 24, 25, rather, the Communist International helped them solve this problem by pointing out it was foolish to try to build a Labor Party when there was no sentiment for it. Now, Cannon tells how, after this period, starting around 1924, 1923 even, there was a difference in the leadership in Moscow. When they had problems, after this, when they had problems, and go to Moscow to have them solved. He didn't understand what it was all about, but he could sense that there was a change in the leadership in Moscow, a change in their attitude towards the solving of these problems that were brought to them by the American section. And instead of giving clear-cut answers to these problems, And quelling the factional struggles that were going on inside the communist movement, they gave decisions that added more fuel to the fire. And instead of the factionalism simmering down, it burst out in the open again because of the interpretation that could be given to various resolutions passed out by the Communist International. The result was, and then there was no education in factionalism. And the result was that factions became a permanent part of the Communist Party. There was Foster and Cannon had their faction, and Rutenberg, Lovestone had their faction. No political differences at all, Cannon said. They come to Moscow, differences were settling on the surface in the United States at plenums and so forth, at conventions. There would be no political differences, but these two factions would stay in a permanent state of armed rebellion against each other, you might say. And Moscow did nothing about it. By 1925, it was such a terrible situation inside the party that Cannon broke away from the Cannon, from the Foster Cannon caucus, and a man named Johnstone, broke away from the Rutenberg group on the basis of do away with the factions. That there was no difference between the two factions, and therefore there was no need of them. Well, now you had three factions. You had the right wing, left wing, and you had Cannon, Lovestone, Johnstone in the middle. And these three factions kept in business right up to 1928. The party was divided into three sections by these factions. Rutenberg, Lovestone, faction controlled the apparatus of the party and the leadership, although they were in a minority. Moscow had ordered the Cannon Foster group to turn the leadership over to Lovestone and Rutenberg. The result was Rutenberg and Lovestone controlled the apparatus of the party, that is, a paper, secretariat of the party, the organizational setup, the organizers, and so forth. Foster controlled the trade union field of the party, and Cannon controlled the